On this week's 51%, we hear about a women's prison choir.
We can always sing, and that, I think, is such a powerful thing that your voice is with you, it's a part of you, and it really can't be taken away, ultimately.
And the coronavirus pandemic presents even more challenges to female veterans in need of housing. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Even when the shadows fall, I will sing, I will sing.
Even when the night is long, I will sing, I will sing. Hallelujah.
Nearly 6 in every 10 women incarcerated in U.S. state prisons are survivors of physical or sexual violence. That's according to the American Civil Liberties Union. Prison often compounds the trauma. Amanda Weber had this in mind when she started a choir inside the women's prison in Shakopee, Minnesota. Natalie Pollard joined. The two are now working together to start what's thought to be the country's first reentry choir. KFAI's Anna Stitt reports.
In Minneapolis, I'm Anna Stitt.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. My name is Natalie Pollard. When I was actually like in my jail cell, I started to revert to songs that I knew. And I know my baby would hear me sing, he would, you know, my vibration of my voice.
By the time Natalie Pollard was pregnant in the Ramsey County Jail, she'd been singing for 25 years since her aunt gave her a Bible song on a cassette tape. She was 8 when she performed it at a family reunion.
God is good, God is good. And from then on, music just, something that I liked doing and I wasn't afraid. And I started to train my voice better by listening to like old songs for like my dad used to listen to. Missing assurance, Jesus is mine.
She grew up in the Wayman AME Church in Minneapolis, singing in the youth choir until she was old enough to sing with the adults. Then her life took a turn.
I met a guy online, and you never really know someone till you start to date them and see their true colors. And I started to notice, you know, once we did begin to date, that he had like a severe drug and alcohol abuse problem. And it got to a point where it started to get out of control. And one thing led to another where I was just telling it, you know, I can't have you around acting like that and being under the influence. And he couldn't take no for an answer. He started to hit me, you know, all the things that consist of abuse, calling me names, threatening me, damaging my property, stalking me. It was one particular morning, which was July 2nd of 2015. And I was 2 months pregnant with his child. He broke into my townhouse. I didn't have my phone on me, and it was in the middle of the night. It was like 3-something in the morning.
Natalie Pollard killed her ex. She spent the next 8 months in jail, waiting for the court to decide whether it was self-defense. She says singing to herself and the baby she was carrying helped her make it through.
I'm free in my mind. I'm free in my heart. I'm not physically free, but they can't never take the songs away from me. They can't never take my joy from music away from me. Even like in the fields, like, you know, my aunt's slaves would sing songs in the fields to help them get through the day, to keep them, keep their faith, because that's all they had, you know, and that's all I had.
A jury found Natalie Pollard guilty of second-degree murder. So she went to prison, joining the disproportionate number of Black women imprisoned for killing a partner with a record of abuse. Soon after she arrived at the Shakopee Correctional Facility, she went into labor and was taken to a nearby hospital under close watch of several corrections officers, or COs. She had a support person there from the Minnesota Prison Doula Project.
And I was listening to a song. It was called The Altar. She played it on her cell phone for me when I was actually in labor. And it actually kind of soothed my contractions. But then I kind of felt uneasy because the correctional officers were like, hey, that music is kind of loud. Not being able to listen to music in childbirth was devastating.
She says she had 24 hours with her newborn before he was taken away and she was taken back to prison.
You know, I'd sit out in the courtyard with some of the ladies and we'd reminisce on songs we'd like. And one of the ladies out there said, "Hey, you have a really great voice. You should join the choir." I said, "Shakopee has a choir?"
The Shakopee Women's Prison does have a choir called Voices of Hope and run by Amanda Weber, a Minneapolis-based conductor. Here she is.
We can always sing. And that, I think, is such a powerful thing that your voice is with you. It's a part of you and it really can't be taken away ultimately.
Natalie was skeptical.
Nah, I ain't singing in no prison choir. I can sing better than that.
But the other women were persistent, and she missed music.
Were you allowed to sing outside of choir?
Secretly. I'd sing in my room. We couldn't sing, like, in the courtyard, because the COs would be like, hey, you're loud. Stop that singing.
So Natalie came to the choir expecting to sing. What she didn't expect was a space without prison staff where women could let their defenses down a bit.
You know, the first day, I actually really liked it. Amanda, you know, sang a song to us and, you know, a lot of women in there were like beginning to cry.
One of the singers was crying like uncontrollably through the whole rehearsal, actually to the point where it made me concerned that maybe I said something offensive or did something wrong. And I just asked if everything was okay. And she said, "Yeah, I never cry. I don't know what's wrong with me." And I just said, "That's music."
A few months later, Natalie found out her conviction had been overturned on a technicality. She told the choir she would be going home.
Everybody was crying because they really knew how much I loved my children and wanted to get home to them and letting them know that I loved them all and that I was going to always remember and keep them in my heart. And then it was like the next week I was gone. They released me from prison. Why should I feel discouraged? When I got out, I had just the clothes on my back. I lost everything and I had to hurry up and redirect my brain. Like, I'm not locked up anymore.
Natalie says it was a struggle to adjust back to life outside, starting over with the added trauma of her time in prison. But she tried hard to avoid depression.
You know, when you get depressed and you get angry, and I didn't want to let my kids down.
The Ramsey County attorney said he planned to retry her case. So she pleaded guilty to manslaughter to avoid going through another trial. It meant a criminal record, but being able to stay out of prison with her kids.
I promised them mommy wasn't leaving anymore.
Natalie isn't the only singer to have left prison. And Amanda says a lot of them have asked her where they can keep singing when they're released.
Minnesota, like, this is the land of 10,000 choirs.
But Amanda says most of those choirs rehearse in the evening when people working in the service industry often have shifts. They don't provide food or childcare, don't meet near public transit, charge membership fees. The list goes on. So Amanda asked Natalie to co-lead a reentry choir with her. She says as far as she's been able to find, it will be the first of its kind in the U.S. Amanda says organizing the choir has been a struggle because the Department of Corrections has a rule that when prisoners are released, they can't be in contact with people they knew as prison volunteers for the length of their parole, plus 2 more years. But the department does make exceptions. So Amanda hopes that as soon as it's safe in terms of COVID-19, women will be allowed to participate. Natalie says she and Amanda were finally able to meet up outside the prison a few months ago.
From her seeing me at my lowest in my life, you know, I was looking, you know, in my prison uniform, to being free in regular clothes and be reconnected without interference was amazing.
For KFAI, I'm Anna Stitt.
Female veterans in New York without a permanent place to live have strikingly few options. And with the COVID-19 pandemic stretching on, they face more challenges than ever. Just a warning that this story contains details some listeners will find difficult to hear. 51%'s Jackie Orchard reports.
The Veterans and Community Housing Coalition, or VCHC, runs the Guardian House in Ballston Spa. It's a halfway house of sorts for female veterans who face homelessness and, often, are coping with addiction and past trauma. It is the only house of its kind in the state, and one of just seven in the country funded by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Cheryl Hage Perez, executive director of VCHC, says it's fundamental to create an all-female safe space for the veterans.
Since the house opened, we've served maybe 70 women. 80% of them have been victims of military sexual trauma and are dealing with addiction, are dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, sleep disorders, which always leads to a homeless situation.
Hage Perez says the first step in healing is always stable housing, because if you don't know if you'll have a safe place to sleep that night, it's hard to focus on anything else. So they set up housing first, then address other needs.
Mental health counseling, addiction counseling, rehab, detox, physical illness.
Hage Perez says most of the female veterans at the Guardian House stay for about 2 years, or until they're ready to live on their own, like Janet Harrington. Harrington is an active-duty Air Force veteran who went through the program and now lives on her own. She says the Guardian House helped her to overcome her sexual trauma.
While in the military, I went in thinking that they were going to show me responsibility, accountability, and all that. But when I reported that I got raped, they started putting me on a guilt trip. What about them, their families? What about the men, men's career? What's your career? So they basically sidelined me into staying shut.
Harrington says she suppressed it for as long as she could.
When I came out, I didn't know how to deal with the trauma and the rapes and the stress that I was under because they kept sending me to Saudi Arabia, that I picked up drugs and alcohol.
Harrington has been sober for almost 5 years now. She credits that to the Guardian House, which gave her rules and a routine.
No drinking, no drugs allowed at all. There's a schedule, like a time you have to be home. I mean, nobody should be out in the street at 11 o'clock at night anyway. If you could afford to go to a bar, you don't need to be here.
Hage Perez says the Guardian House is partially funded by the VA, partially by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and partially by other state agencies. The rest comes from donations and fundraising, like the annual Veterans Ball, which Hage Perez says usually has over 400 guests and donors, but is off this year due to COVID-19. So they're getting creative. On Veterans Day in November, the Veteran and Community Housing Coalition is holding a live feed from Cafe Lena as a fundraiser.
We plan to have video clips of some of the veterans that we served and where they were, how they got there, and where they are now.
Hage Perez says they will honor veterans from the community, World War II vets, and a fallen hero. In the meantime, Harrington has some advice for any female veterans who are in danger of becoming homeless or struggling with addiction or past trauma, but are nervous about contacting the Guardian House.
Run there. Give yourself time to heal like I did. And now today I could actually enjoy life.
For 51%, I'm Jackie Orchard.
Modus Monologues, the UndocuAmerica series, features stories from the front lines and front porches of your undocumented neighbors. The stories from the UndocuAmerica series were developed as part of a creative collaboration between Modus Theater in Colorado and a group of undocumented people living in the United States. In this monologue, you'll hear Kiara Chavez tell a story of flying home to Mexico for the first time since she was 4 to see her ailing grandmother. She was able to travel as part of the advanced parole program that once allowed youth with DACA or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival status to leave the country for work, education, or humanitarian reasons. These visits are no longer allowed because the advanced parole program was terminated in 2017.
The longest plane ride of my life was for my trip to Mexico when I was 19, so about 2 years ago now. I don't remember packing. I don't remember the drive to the airport. I don't even remember much about all the forms I had to fill out, or how much my family had to pay to apply for advanced parole. That's the program that used to allow DACA recipients to leave the country for study abroad, employment, or, as in my case, a humanitarian reason. My grandma was having surgery, and she needed someone who could care for her as she recovered. I don't even remember much about the conversations with my worried parents about the dangers of me traveling. You see, although advanced parole granted me permission from the U.S. government to lawfully leave the country, it didn't actually guarantee I would be let back in. Spoiler alert, I made it back. What I remember most is being on the plane, because I'll never forget how my heart beat faster the closer we got to taking off. The plane was going to Puerto Vallarta. I'm actually from Colima, but they don't have a direct flight from Denver, and this is one of the closest airports. So you can imagine, I was surrounded by American tourists ready to vacation. Meanwhile, I sat there just about vibrating from nervousness or excitement. I'm not sure which. Either way, I just wanted to vomit, but luckily for the tourists on the flight, the knot in my throat kept holding it down. Other people on the plane were chatting, making last-minute phone calls, getting out their reading material, and I was having a complete nervous breakdown. My hands sweating, my breathing fast, my whole body shaking. When I finally heard the pilot say we were heading out and the plane began to move, my mind started racing. I couldn't stop thinking about what my life had consisted of the past 15 years since I crossed the border at age 4 and left my first home. All the nights as a child crying in my parents' arms asking, "Why can't I go back and see my family? Why, Mama? Why?" All the calls to my grandmas and the long kisses I would send them over the phone, hoping these kisses would somehow reach them all the way from Denver to Colima. All the pictures of the beaches, my grandparents, the aunts and uncles who I once knew so well, now getting older, photograph by photograph, having an entirely different life without me. As a child, I didn't understand why I couldn't go to Mexico. And still, I trusted that this was something I simply couldn't do. But now, somehow, at the age of 19, I was returning, and my heart was just about to burst. I remember when the plane finally sped across the runway and lifted off into the air, I began crying with abandon as if I was totally alone. Just me, launching into flight, somehow through both space and time. In my head, I kept hearing my grandma's voices, the way they used to soothe me over the phone when I was little. "Mija, please don't cry. God willing, we will hold one another soon. Please don't cry anymore." Those phone calls were so painful because I could hear them, but I couldn't touch them, hold them, smell their hair. My older sister could go to Mexico. She's an American citizen who was born in the U.S. when my father was working in California. Every few years during our childhood, she would get on a plane to go to Mexico and return with sweets from my aunt's candy store and a collection of photos of her smiling next to my grandparents, aunts, uncles, and the cousins who I had never met. But I simply could not return. That was the rule, because I was born in Mexico. My sister could enroll in the best private schools in Denver and attend on scholarship. I was smart too, and tested in as well, but I couldn't go, because as an undocumented person, I wasn't eligible for financial aid, and there was no way my parents could afford the tuition. My fellow classmates at the high school could fly to Europe and study the art I loved and strive to imitate with my own brush. But but I couldn't join them to see the frescoes and the ancient columns myself because another DACA student had tried and they didn't let her back into the country. Instead, she and her whole family were deported. I had spent my whole life reconciling myself to the solidity of barriers between me and my dreams, and the invisible borders between me and what I loved. But now, suddenly, I was flying over 500 miles an hour straight through the biggest and most painful barrier of them all, between me and my family. I just kept thinking, is this real life? It can't be. Can I actually believe this is true when so many of my dreams have been thwarted at the last minute? Is it really true that I'll be landing in Mexico and seeing my family? It can't be. But now, for the first time on that plane, I could see it was actually coming true and I was sobbing again. Like my 4-year-old self, picturing my grandmas thinking, I'm making it to their arms and they are still alive. We are alive. Midway through the flight, still shaking, I began to become aware again that there were others still on that plane. I managed to wipe my tears and I smiled, finally excited. I laughed at myself thinking, wow, they must think I'm crazy or really scared of flying. But how could they ever understand the magnitude of this moment in my life? I'm fulfilling the American immigrant's dream. My dream. I'm seeing my family after 15 years. And I want to yell it across the aisles and tell the whole plane what a triumphant day they are a part of. It's real. It's real. I'm returning to see my family. Meet my family. The lineage of people whose love and existence have filled my veins with blood and my belly with culture. I'm going to step my feet on the dirt I was molded from and breathe the humid air my lungs were meant to breathe. I'm fulfilling the prophecy my mom commenced when she threw my umbilical cord on top of the house that my father and my grandfather built because she believed it would one day bring me back home. I, Kiara Yoselin Chavez Garcia, am returning home. I'm returning to myself.
The OnDocu America autobiographical monologue was created by Kiara Chavez in collaboration with Modus Theater Artistic Director Kirsten Wilson as part of a Modus Monologue project. And you can hear feminist Gloria Steinem read and reflect on Chavez's story in Modus Theater's companion podcast, Shoebox Stories, where prominent Americans step into the shoes of our undocumented neighbors.
100 years ago, American women won the right to vote. I'm Marty Moscowane. This is Women 100, a series celebrating women who made possible a century of progress, women like Shirley Chisholm. She was born in Brooklyn in 1924 and spent her childhood living with her grandmother in Barbados. In 1968, Chisholm was the first Black woman elected to Congress. 4 years later, she ran for president, the first African American to seek a major party's nomination. During her years in state government and in Congress, she was an outspoken advocate for children, women, and people of color, and a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus. Chisholm's 1970 autobiography was titled Unbought and Unbossed. She died in 2005 and was posthumously honored with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Produced by WHYY with Drexel University. For more information, go to whyy.org/women100.
This is Bird Note. At a mountain summit in Vermont, Among gnarled and stunted spruce and fir, dawn breaks with this unique sound. The swirling serenade of a Bicknell's thrush. Corduroy brown above and pale below, with messy spots on its breast, the thrush isn't really known for its good looks. It's known for scarcity and promiscuity. Unlike most songbirds, the female thrush establishes a territory and then mates with males that happen by. She then lays eggs that have been fertilized by multiple different males. Many of those males will stick around and help feed the young, even if they are not their own. Bicknell's thrushes are exceedingly rare, and they face an uncertain future with climate change and habitat loss. Yet each year, this little songbird makes the long journey from the Caribbean islands to the forests of the northeastern coasts of North America to make a call that a few of us may be lucky enough to hear in person. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. Find us at birdnote.org.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1622.